The Joint House and Senate Claims Subcommittee is now called to order, and we will start with Agenda Item 3, a review of Senate File 1857 and House File 2371. Ms. Timms.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There are two identical bills in your packet. The first engrossment of Senate File 1857, and also in the extra papers that Casey prepared for you, there's the first engrossment of House File 2371. Those bills almost made it through the committee deadlines. Senate File 1857 was heard on April 1st and passed Senate Judiciary. Senator Goodwin carried that bill. Representative Murphy's bill was approved in House Government Operations on April 7th, but at that meeting it was referred to House Civil Law. So while it technically didn't meet the deadline, it was heard this morning in Civil Law for informational purposes. So in reality, it has been through all of the policy committees in the House and the Senate. And so what the bills would do, as you know, for many years, the Subcommittee on Claims has been hearing property claims that are denied at the Department of Corrections, property claims from inmates who allege that property was lost or damaged by negligence of state employees. And what the bill would do in Sections 1 and 2 is clarify the procedure for hearing these property claims and make it clear that Department of Human Services individuals similarly situated are included. And it also would add to the exception in the tort liability statute. We still have the exception that the courts will not hear any claims regarding this type of property, but it can be heard through the subcommittee, which is an exclusive remedy. Then Section 3 would raise the dollar value for the claims for sentenced to service individuals to $7,000 from the current $5,000. Why $7,000? Well, because there's a much more general statute, 3.732, that gives all state agencies the authority right now to settle any claim, a death claim, a property claim, an injury claim, up to $7,000. So this would make, Section 3 would make this provision consistent with the general state law, and it would also allow the Department of Corrections to pay medical claims to providers up to that amount and not have them waiting for a year or more to have their claim heard at the subcommittee. And then finally, Section 4 would raise the filing fee for legislative claims from $5 to $8. And that originally it was 10. Representative Murphy, who carried the bill in the House, was more comfortable with 8, trying to balance the ability of prisoners who don't make a lot of money to be able to file claims, but with trying to find an amount that would weed out frivolous claims. So that is that summarizes the contents of these bills, and the suggestion I might have is that we could put this language as Article 3 in the claims bill and move it forward through that vehicle. So in order to do that, I think we would need a resolution approving the language for inclusion in the claims bill.
And I think what we'll do, since we have a quorum and members present, we'd entertain a motion to approve the minutes from April 15, 2015.
So moved.
Representative Felton.
Mr. Chairman, so moved.
Thank you. All in favor of approving the minutes from April 15, 2015, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Approved. And then we would entertain a motion if we wish to add this as a section.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is with the proposal, I guess, is Ms. Timmons suggesting that the House version then be the version that we go with or the Senate version? I'm just a little bit confused about what the suggestion is.
Ms. Timmons.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, the first engrossments of Senate File 1857 and the first engrossment of House File 2371 are identical. Okay. So either one, it's the same language.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I gather it's Ms. Timmons' suggestions that we do this, and so moved. I'll make the motion, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion or questions from members? Seeing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. It passes. And I think, Ms. Timmons, if you wanted to continue with the agenda.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, the next item on the agenda would be to... if you so choose to adopt the changes or proposed amendments to the rules of procedure for the Subcommittee on Claims. In the early part of your binders here, there's a memorandum from me dated March 30th of 2016 that really talks about these new exoneration claims under the Imprisonment and Exoneration Remedies Act, and discusses all the statutory procedures that claimants must go through before being able to bring a claim to our committee. So first, there has to be an order for determining eligibility for compensation under Minnesota Statutes 590.11. And a court has to determine that the individuals are entitled to exoneration. The prosecutor, original prosecuting office, must represent the state at that juncture. Then the next step, if that order is obtained, then the claimant may file in the Minnesota Supreme Court. And upon filing of that claim, a three-judge panel would be appointed by the court. Then there is a fourth step that includes pre-hearing settlements, and if no settlement can be reached, a requirement that the three-judge panel hear all of the evidence. Then step five is a final award of damages, and Minnesota Statute 611.365 talks about what damages can be awarded and does include, for example, non-economic damages. So that's one area where it's different from what is in the normal procedures for the subcommittee, where we do not typically give damages for pain and suffering. These claims are different. And there can be judicial review of that final award. And then step six, the final step that we're about to embark upon for the first time since this legislation was passed in 2014, is consideration of the final awards by the legislature. So because of the fact that the process for these exoneration awards is different and has some different parameters, there are proposed amendments to the rules of procedure in your packet that essentially says rule of procedure number one is we don't consider any claim over which another tribunal or court has jurisdiction. Well, the proposed amendment to the rules of procedure would make an exception to that rule for these final awards under the statutory provisions. And then at the end of the proposed rules, there is a proposal to add a paragraph 14 that goes through specific procedures for these final awards of damages, that they're to be submitted to the subcommittee by the Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget as required by statute, include the court order from the compensation panel, as well as that original court order I talked about that establishes the ability to get compensation based on exoneration, establishing that neither the claimant nor the claimant's counsel is required to file any documentation, that there would be no filing fee for this type of claim, that neither the claimant nor the claimant's counsel is required to testify, but testimony is permitted. The procedures would also give the chair of the subcommittee discretion to limit testimony on these exoneration claims, both by content and in terms of time, and then stating that consistent with Minnesota Statute 611.367, the subcommittee may include recommendation of the final award in the annual claims appropriation bill for consideration by the full legislature. So that explains the reasons behind the proposed amendments to the rules of procedure and goes through what they would be.
Okay, members, are there any questions in regards to the rules changes proposed? Are there any? Then would anyone have a motion to adopt these? Representative Felton?
Mr. Chairman, I will make a motion to adopt these amendments to the rules.
Thank you. Any questions or discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting these new rules, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Passes. Approved. Now, Ms. Timms, if you can go into a little bit of a additional summary of the act. I know you covered some there. And if Ms. Anderson and Deputy Commissioner Hallstrom could get ready. Okay, Ms. Timms.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, I think I went over the process, the highlights of the process that is set out in statute for these exoneration awards. And with that, I think perhaps it would be best to let the representatives from MMB go into more detail.
Thank you. And who would wish to go first? Okay, Deputy Commissioner Hallstrom, if you could enlighten us with a little background before we start into the actual claims. Thank
Absolutely.
You, Mr. Hallstrom.
Good evening. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Hallstrom. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. I'm pleased to be here this evening to provide testimony in support of three compensation awards submitted pursuant to the Imprisonment and Exoneration Remedies Act. The individuals who brought these claims have traveled very different paths, but they seek a common goal, and that's to be made whole for the losses that they endured as a result of their wrongful convictions. Given their experiences, it's my hope the process will help in some small way to restore their belief in a system where justice can prevail. Now, each of you, I believe, has been provided as part of your materials information relating to each of the three awards. My understanding that would include the panel's actual award, which is, I think, actually styled an order granting joint motion for summary disposition, but that is the award. The settlement agreement and order of eligibility exoneration compensation, as mentioned by Ms. Timmons. You also have, I think, a chart that sets out the damages included in each claimant's award, and I'll speak to that momentarily. Since the act is relatively new and the submissions before you are the first to reach the legislature, I thought it might make sense to start with a little bit of a an overview of the statutory and claim process, and then move to the specifics of the three claims before the committee. As Ms. Timmons mentioned, the Imprisonment and Exoneration Remedies Act was passed in 2014 with the purpose of providing compensation for individuals who were wrongly convicted of a felony who would serve time in prison. Just to follow up on the process set out by Ms. Timmons, to be eligible for compensation under the Act, an individual must be exonerated in the first instance, meaning that their conviction was vacated or reversed on grounds consistent with innocence, and that the prosecutor dismissed their charges, or alternatively, a new trial is ordered on the grounds consistent with innocence, and the prosecutor dismisses the charges, or the petitioner is found not guilty of their original charges at a new trial. And then a court must order the petitioner eligible for compensation based on exoneration in the interest of justice. And to obtain such an order, the prosecutor must either join the petitioner's motion, or the petitioner must prove that he or she did not commit the crime for which they were convicted. After obtaining an order for eligibility from the district court, the petitioner can bring a claim for compensation. And it's important for me to note at the outset that MMB is not involved in any part of the exoneration process or any of the process through which the claimant actually establishes eligibility for compensation. Instead, there's a specific process involving the county prosecutor and the district court. That entire process occurs prior to any involvement by MMB. Once a compensation claim is filed with the Minnesota Supreme Court, it's served on the state by serving MMB, who acts on behalf of the state in the process with legal representation provided by the Attorney General's Office and MMB's counsel. Our counsel, Kristen Anderson, is with us tonight. The Supreme Court appoints a three-person compensation panel comprised of judges or attorneys with experience in settlement and damages, usually in tort claims. And then the panel is ultimately responsible for determining the amount of damages awarded. The panel can hold a settlement conference where the parties must make a good faith attempt to reach a settlement in the case. MMB's role in such a settlement conference is to be a responsible steward of the public interest and the public resources. We negotiate in good faith. We ensure that damages awarded are consistent with the statutory language and supported by the facts and are fair and reasonable in light of a risk of a greater award through the panel through an evidentiary hearing. And if the parties do reach a settlement, they present to the panel with a motion to accept that settlement in lieu of a hearing, and if acceptable to the panel issues an award. If the parties cannot reach a settlement, the panel will hold an evidentiary hearing, as I mentioned, and they will base their award on the results of that evidentiary hearing. Once an award is issued and forwarded to MMB, the statute requires us to submit the amount of the final award to the legislature for consideration during the next session. And that brings us to the claims that are before you this evening. We've submitted three awards to the legislature, and for each of these claims, the process we followed was more or less the same. The panel was comprised of a judge who acted as the chair and included a plaintiff's and defense attorney who were experienced in tort claims. In each claim, we entered into settlement negotiations with the claimant, and in each case, the panel members participated as mediators at that settlement conference. The panel members were very involved in assessing the claims during the mediation and were extremely helpful in guiding the parties to reach fair and reasonable terms acceptable to both sides. As I mentioned earlier, members of the committee should have a chart for each award that sets out the relevant statutory damage provision, the category of damages, the maximum amount or damage cap if one exists for that category, and the amount agreed to through the settlement and ultimately awarded by the panel. At the top of each chart, I believe, is also the minimum monetary damages that particular claimant is entitled to under the statute. I just want to briefly address the damages that were awarded by the panel to each of the claimants. Out of respect for the privacy of the claimants, I'm going to refrain from discussing any of the details of the basis for their non-economic damages awarded. I can share with you, however, that each of the claimants made very compelling cases for the damages that were awarded, and it's my understanding the claimants are here this evening and may choose to speak when I'm through. The first claim was brought by Kua Fong Lee. Mr. Lee served 2.8 years in prison He was tried in Ramsey County and convicted of criminal vehicular homicide for a crash that resulted in the death of three people. On his petition for post-conviction relief, the judge determined there was sufficient evidence to vacate the conviction and to grant a new trial based on new evidence consistent with innocence. That evidence primarily related to malfunction in certain Toyota vehicles, resulting in sudden acceleration. The county attorney then dismissed all charges and stipulated to an order for eligibility for compensation under the Act. After the Supreme Court established the panel in this matter, the parties were brought together to attempt a settlement, which was mediated by panel members, including Judge Margaret Daly of Hennepin County. In that settlement, the parties agreed to the following damages, which were ultimately awarded by the panel. I'll just go through those very quickly. The capped damages were comprised of $84,000 in lost wages, $20,645.13 in reimbursement for fees and costs associated with Mr. Lee's original criminal defense, and $4,503 in costs for education and training. So Mr. Lee's capped damages totaled $109,148.13, which is substantially less than the $280,000 which would have been permitted under the statutory cap. In uncapped damages, the award provides for $270,000 in non-economic damages for personal non-physical injuries and $16,000 for attorney's fees related to his exoneration compensation claim. So Mr. Lee's total award comes to $395,148.13.
Mr. Hillstrom, members, the newest version would be these that have been three-hole punched. And the idea is to get the general background and process. Then we will get into each of the specific cases. And remember, we're not, our purview is not to adjudicate anything. It's to look at, the merits of the claim. It goes through the process and handle it as we do the other claims. And Mr. Hillstrom, if you could continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the next claim, I'll just proceed through each of the claims, and then if there are questions, I can address those at the conclusion. The next claim was brought by Michael Hansen. Mr. Hansen served 5.7 years in prison, and he was tried and convicted in Douglas County for the murder of his infant daughter. On his petition for post-conviction relief, the judge determined there was sufficient evidence to vacate the conviction and grant a new trial based on new evidence consistent with innocence. That evidence suggested his daughter had passed away from accidental suffocation in her sleep, sometimes referred to as SIDS, and that a fracture of her skull was likely caused by an accidental fall several days earlier and not by abuse. The county attorney then dismissed the charges and stipulated to an order for eligibility of compensation under the Act. And again, the parties were brought together to attempt a settlement, which was mediated again by panel members. Through that mediation, the parties agreed to the following damages, which were then awarded by the panel. The cap damages were comprised of $142,500 in lost wages, $108,846.76 in reimbursement for fees and costs associated with Mr. Hansen's original criminal defense, and $18,670 in costs for education and training. Mr. Hansen's cap damages totaled $270,016.76. The statute would have permitted up to $570,000 under the statutory cap. With respect to uncapped damages, the panel awarded $1,812 as reimbursement for restitution and costs required by his judgment and sentence in the original conviction, $60,000 in non-economic damages for personal physical injuries, and $570,000 for non-economic damages for personal non-physical injuries, and $15,000 for attorney's fees related to his exoneration compensation claim. Mr. Hansen's total award is $916,828.76. The final exoneration compensation award before the committee this evening is Roger Lee Olson's. Mr. Olson served just under a year and a half in prison. He was tried for and convicted in Houston County for criminal sexual conduct with a minor. and on his petition for post-conviction relief, the judge determined there was sufficient evidence to vacate the conviction and grant a new trial based on new evidence consistent with innocence. That evidence was that the victim had fabricated her accusations. The county attorney dismissed all charges and stipulated to an order of eligibility for compensation under the Act, and at settlement, the parties agreed to the following damages, which the panel then awarded. Cap damages were comprised of $42,908 in lost wages and $872.48 in reimbursement for child support or interest associated with child support payments. Mr. Olson's cap damages totaled $43,780.48, much less than the $136,000 permitted under the statutory cap. The panel awarded the following uncapped damages as well: $15,500 in reimbursement for medical and dental expenses, $263,179.52 in non-economic damages for personal physical injuries, $137,000 for non-economic damages for personal non-physical injuries, and $15,540 for attorney's fees related to Mr. Olson's exoneration compensation claim. So Mr. Olson's total award was $475,000. So in conclusion, as I explained before, on behalf of Minnesota Management and Budget and the state of Minnesota, I believe these settlements in all these cases and the panel awards that based on those settlements are fair and consistent with the statutory language and intent and are supported by the facts, and I believe payment of these claims is in the interest of the state, in the interest of the claimants, and ultimately in the interest of justice. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions the committee members might have.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Hellstrom. Members, now I thought we would entertain questions on the general before we get into stepping through each of the three, and then I would hope that we then would do a determination after hearing all three. Since this is the first time through, I understand that there probably are some questions that might pop up as we look at the individual cases. So are there any questions among members? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just had a question about how the statutory process works. I want to note the presence of the author of this program, Representative Lesh, in the audience. But I had a question. Does this exhaust claims that these individuals may make against the state or against jurisdictions other than this? I had thought the answer was yes, but I was flipping through trying to see.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. I'll have the author of the bill maybe give us some insight of legislative intent. If you want to approach the table, and I'll have the committee counsel maybe make any clarifying statements. Ms. Timms? Go with you. Okay. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I want to thank all of you who have been sentenced to serve to this commission. I did a couple of terms on this commission and read through those binders, perhaps not as exhaustively as Representative Murphy did, but I appreciate your service. To answer the question, I would state this, that it does, in fact, offset the claims, but does not completely exhaust them. But why don't I allow Ms. Jonas to explain it more thoroughly?
Ms. Jonas, if you could state your name and affiliation for the record.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Lesh, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Julie Jonas. I'm the legal director for the Minnesota Innocence Project. We worked with Representative Lesh in passing this bill in 2014. It does not completely extinguish claims that the individual exoneree may have against the state, particularly for specific wrongdoings, for instance, under a 1983 claim. But any award that they were to get through this process would offset any damages that the state would be required to pay under such a separate suit.
Thank you. Representative Pinto, a follow-up?
No, thank you.
Members, any additional? Senator Johnson or Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess what concerns me, I guess, is just why this is before this committee. And I know I did mention that before when we were just chatting here, where it says that The statute does not give further guidance as to what the legislature's consideration may include. These claims are for our consideration. What is the definition of consideration?
Thank you, Senator Carlson. I'll have Ms. Timms make a comment on that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, the statute doesn't elucidate what the term consideration means. I did look at the history of the legislation, and originally MMB was simply to pay the claims out of MMB funds, and if there weren't enough funds to cover the awards, then MMB was to request the amount in their next budget. But somewhere along the line in one of the engrossments, that provision was taken out of the legislation, and instead the requirement that these claims come before the legislature for consideration was inserted. So this is the first time through. But what I was trying to do with the memo, really outlining all the statutory procedures, was to explain that there has been a lot of process that has come before this stage, and these awards are embodied in court orders. So as your legal counsel, I don't wish to tell you you can't do something if there's something you really wish to consider, of course, because the language does leave it somewhat open, and we never know what kinds of cases might come before us in the future. But the process appears to be designed to have the final stage be more of a yes or no vote.
Senator Carlson.
Yeah, just the follow-up, and that's kind of where I was leading, where it says these final awards of damages are court orders permitted by statute and should be given the same deference as a court order issued by a separate branch of government. So that what that seems to me is that it's an up or down, and it's not that renegotiation, relitigation, any discussion about the fairness is not really our purview here. It's an up or down.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. And part of the discussions I've been involved with it didn't really seem like it belonged in one of the committees and count against their budget. The claims tend to be a broad extra budget type way of doing it. It's a little bit cleaner, I think, straightforward, and I think it fits well the first time. And as you know, we're adopting rules, getting used to it. I think we're going to do some learning, but frankly, that way, it doesn't. A couple million dollars may impact a committee where this being pulled out of the budget targets is the whole budget or whole legislature authorizing the funds. So that is my understanding why it might fit in here. Are there any other Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, I asked these questions too, and I found that what you said is exactly right. We're a joint subcommittee, and so that's House and Senate together. So we will hear it, and then it doesn't have to go to other committees. And the bill is being carried financially in the Ways and Means other bills. And so it's not affecting any Finance Committee's target.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. And I would just add, it's basically meeting obligations of the state without impacting, the individual, whether it's corrections, DNR, et cetera. And I think we could probably move, unless there are further questions, move on to the 5.1. And I would invite if the claimant wishes to speak. There's no requirement that happen. And the others, you know, stay close by. So I have Michael Ray Hansen. I've got Julie Jones, and I have Elizabeth Emerson. And Michael Ray Hansen?
Yeah.
Please state your name for the committee.
Michael Ray Hansen.
And any statements or testimony?
I want to thank you all for being here today and for hearing this. It's very important to myself, my family, and my children. I'm sorry if I get a little emotional. I just, even talking about it, I get visually shaken. The thought of being in prison and having to relive it, even talking about it, is really hard for me. So please bear with me. I was wrongfully convicted of my daughter's death in 2006. I did not harm her in any way. I love my children and was devastated by the loss of my 4-month-old daughter, Avriana. My parents took a second mortgage out on their house that they're still paying for to this day, since 2006. And they're still paying for it. They're very hard-working people and would be ready to retire if it wasn't for this. After spending over 6 years in prison, the Innocence Project of Minnesota proved that the medical examiner who testified on my about my daughter's death was wrong, and I was finally released from prison. While I was in prison, my daughters thought that their father killed their sister. They grew up from little girls who I was close to, and to teenagers I hardly knew. I wasn't able to see my 3-year-old go. When I left, she was 3 years old. I wasn't able to see her get on the bus for the first time going to school. Going to prison as someone who murdered a child makes you the lowest of low in prison, and I had a target on my back the whole time. While I was in prison, I got beat up, but I could never report this for fear of being called a snitch or in getting it worse. I had to literally bring my mentality down to the prison mentality. Now, that I wasn't used to. I didn't know anything about that stuff or anything like that. And I didn't think they would affect me. I thought maybe I was just kind of putting on a cloak so that the other inmates wouldn't, you know, label me and target me and things. And but that toughness changed me. And that toughness isn't right for society out here. I did everything I could to do rehabilitation stuff that I wasn't even mandated to do in there. I never got in trouble. I actually got a recommendation from the warden there, talking about how good of an inmate I was for over all those years. And prison changed me. I didn't realize it was happening at the time, but slowly but surely, as I got out, I realized that I wasn't the same and I felt different than other people. I didn't have that gray area. Things were really black and white to me. Literally just somebody walking down a hall and bumping into you. In prison, you give respect, otherwise things are going to happen right then and there. It's very simple. There is no gray area. My interactions with people are different because of the prison mentality I had to adapt. It's its own beast. I work every day against it because it is not suitable for society, but it makes me feel like I am not like everyone else. I used to trust the system, believe in the police and law and order. Now I don't. I used to get football cards from the police as a kid. Now I avoid them and tell my kids to do the same. I continue to see a therapist. I was diagnosed with PTSD from 2 separate therapists. Nothing can give me back the time I lost, the time my daughters lost, the time my parents lost, and other family members. I'll never get that time back, ever. And it changed me. And I don't know if I'll ever get myself back. I hope you will pass this legislation. I went through a lot to get here. It won't fix everything, but hopefully it can make things better. And I think the people need to see that Minnesota is held accountable too, and they can apologize too, and they can stand up and be moral. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. And is it Mr. Lee?
Yes.
Go ahead, Mr. Lee. State your name.
Thank you. My name is Kuo Fong Lee, and I was wrongfully convicted of vehicular homicide in 2007 after my Toyota Camry accelerated uncontrollable at the end of the freeway exit ramps in St. Paul. And our car crashed into three vehicles, ultimately killing a man and two children. And after spending 2 years, 9 months, and 24 days in prison, Toyota revealed that some of its cars were experiencing acceleration issues. The Innocent Project of Minnesota helped my team of lawyers prove that my car malfunctioned, causing it to accelerate and crash. I spent nearly 3 years in prison before I was exonerated and released. And during this time, I missed the birth of my youngest child. It broke my heart to miss this important moment in my family's life. And my wife and I have 4 young children. When I was released from prison, my children did not know who I was. The 2 oldest had lost touch with me, and the 2 youngest did not know me at all. It took a long time for me to earn their trust and build my credibility of as a father. And still today, when my daughter, youngest daughter, Angel, draw a family picture, and I was not in the drawing, my family suffered a great loss that still continues to affect us today. I have been seeking therapy 2 times a month since I got out of prison. But today, I'm proud to say that this coming fall, I will graduate from Metro State University with a Bachelor of Social Work degree. And my time in prison set me back many years career-wise. But I'm working as hard as I can to get my life back where it was, so that I can be the provider I want to be for my family. And nothing can change the time that I've spent away from my family and change what my family and I went through. But this compensation statute will help a little bit. And today I urge you to pass this legislation because it is the right thing to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Is Mr. Olson, aren't required to have to. I know it's traumatic. Okay. If you would approach the table and then Mr. Olson, if you'd say your name for the record and you know when you're ready.
My name's Roger Olson. I was accused of the assaulting my stepdaughter. I don't know how to explain things that when people are in there for stuff like that. Being in prison for a crime like the other guy was saying, I don't know how to even explain that stuff. I still go through it every single day because of the nature of the crime against a child. Everywhere I go, it's there all the time. I can't move on with my life. I can't get my life back. Psychiatrists can't, they don't know what they do to help. They've never seen a case like mine before. And I'm just thankful for you people listening to this, taking your time on this stuff. And I hope you would pass this for the people that are accused of things but never done anything wrong. And it destroys their lives. But all I can say is I'm going to go nuts here.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. And now that we've heard from the claimants, I don't know if there are any questions. There are others that are listed for testifying. I don't know if if you're just available for questions, that's fine too. I think the three gentlemen conveyed a good.
They did, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I cannot convey any more than the three testifiers did of how important your action is to them on this, but also to the people of Minnesota who never want to believe that we made a mistake that affects the lives of an innocent person as much as we did in the case of these three men. But if we do, we know that we can do something to make it right, or at least compensate them for this. So with that, no other comments, but I would stand for questions,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, I just want to comment, and of course, I sympathize with all three of the cases, but I just want to ask you a couple of questions. On one of these cases, it dealt with a Toyota where the state didn't realize when they were making any adjudication of this, there was, to my knowledge, nothing that the state did improperly, inaccurately. The judge didn't put his thumb on the scales of justice. The state didn't do anything wrong. Now we find out that Toyota was doing something wrong, and I know you're an attorney. Don't you think that that particular case certainly has a case against Toyota for what they actually did in this situation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Osmond, there was a case against Toyota in that instance, and the circumstances of that case pending. I don't actually have all the details of what had occurred, but no, I think you're absolutely right in the civil instance that did proceed. So it's a matter of public record. I couldn't tell you exactly what the details of it were right now.
Senator Osmond?
Thank you. And the last case that came up with the an individual making a false claim, now, this, again, the state took what they believed was the truth from the individual. The state didn't do anything. The judge didn't do anything. Now they recanted it was found to be a lie. Can you enlighten me? Was there something during either of these two, the other one with the medical examiner? I think I could probably make a case on that one, but I'm just trying to find where the state was responsible for something during the sequence of events that would make us culpable.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesh
and Senator Osmick, I was a prosecutor for 15 years, as I think you know. And there's no question that when cases come through, especially cases where you have a sympathetic victim, a victim of domestic assault, a victim who's a child, a family, folks that died as part of a family, they're very sympathetic victims. And I would note this, that when we were crafting this bill, we worked closely with the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. As you can imagine, they were very hesitant to have this be called wrongful conviction because it suggested they did something wrong. But I think the accord that we reached with the county attorneys is to make clear that we're Monday morning quarterbacking this thing. There's no question about it. You could say that in the case of each one of these, well, in some of them it was circumstantial evidence, and others of them there was direct evidence that was false. You could say that a prosecutor should have seen that. I don't know if we can say that, right? I don't know if, in fact, we can say that for sure. But the point of passing the bill was to say that we're not – it's kind of like a no-fault statute, if you will, kind of like we have for car insurance. We're not going to cast blame about who should have done what. All we're going to do is look at the fact that what should have happened, knowing all the facts that we know now, didn't, and therefore we're going to compensate them because that's justice. But I think you're absolutely right. Trying to find some source of the wrong is something that we've tried to do, but even if we did, there's no way we could roll back the years that these men did in prison.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. A follow-up? Any other questions or comments from members? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess the thing that I'm just trying to figure out procedurally here is it does make sense to me this is a court order that's been directed towards us. The legislation says that the legislature has to consider the award, and I understand from Ms. Timmons the thought is that what we do is review simply to be sure the statute was followed, which is good. I guess I'd be concerned, though, in the future that a future claims committee might not follow that or might – I mean, I guess it just does seem like we're in an odd position in terms of having both a court award that is then reviewed by the legislature, and we talked about this before. But if a court orders the state to pay a certain amount in a court case, that doesn't go through the legislature. That is something that is – you know, the state has to pay that amount of money. So I guess I might just suggest this be something that we would consider for the future, just procedurally, if that makes sense, rather than having to be something that would be considered by the legislature and go through once we have a court order telling us how much to pay. If that makes sense to the Representative Lesh or to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. I think the legislature has a way of learning that whatever we pass does need adjustment or improvement, and I trust that some of the members here and other members, you know, in the future will learn. But, you know, again, this is the first opportunity with this law, and I think we're handling it appropriately. And if something does, you know, we do learn something, I'll be the first to help join in trying to improve it. Any comments, Representative Lesh?
Well, I agree. There's no question, because this is the first time the law that we passed in 2014 has been applied. It's a matter of first impression, and I think the way that you've handled it now is exactly the way it should be handled and should set the standard for subsequent claims of this type. I would note, however, though, that legislative compliance with the order of a court is not something that's new. I mean, we see that with the sex offender program. Okay, so there are various situations where we end up butting heads once in a while. But I don't think this, with how you set the stage for this now, hopefully this will not be one of those in future claims.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. And being a co-equal branch of government, often we have to, work out any differences. Again, any other questions? Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just getting it clear in my mind. So what we're doing here is we are making sure that the process has taken place. We have no jurisdiction over the claims themselves. We do what the court says if we find that the process has followed the process that's in statute. Then we have no recourse to vote no at this point. Is that a clear... As muddy as I can make it, I guess.
I think I'll have the committee counsel comment before I step forward.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Osmick, the statute is not crystal clear because it simply says these claims are to be brought to the legislature for consideration, and it really doesn't elucidate. But when you look at the entire statutory process, where first they have to get this order that they're even entitled to exoneration, and then go through a separate process to establish the amount of damages, the best advice I can give you is that I believe the intent looks to be, was the statutory process followed? That's the primary thing that should be determined in considering the claims. But, you know, the statute is just uses that word consideration. So what I'm saying is look at the context of the statutory scheme, and that seems to determine the appropriate action.
Thank you, Ms. Timmons. And I guess, you know, frankly, we have each have our election certificates. We each have probably a slightly different interpretation, and that's why we meet, we discuss, and we vote. So is there any follow-up or other query? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to ask some history. In the past, there was a limitation in state liability for wrongdoing, and it was $300,000 per incident, per person, I believe it was, and $1 million per incident. And I know that we had settlements. I was on one of the committees that heard the bridge compensation bill, and that was an amount that, you know, we departed from those smaller numbers, and everyone was comfortable with that. But during the process, I remember hearing about other large claims that the state had paid. And I'm wondering if those had come through the claims committee. And I'm thinking of one in particular. I hate to really mention it, but it's the Shadeen case that maxed out. And I believe there were a few others like that. Were those through the claims committee?
Ms. Timms.
No, Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, no, those did not go through the claims committee. Those went through the normal court tort process, more of a negligence-based tort claim. And the limitations of liability for the state is the general statute regarding cases against the state in tort. And at one time it was $300,000. I believe we looked up the current limit and it's $1.5 million now. So, yes, there are definitely tort claims brought against the state that go through the typical court process.
Those were actually the action of the legislature were similar to these in that they were a court order, and the legislature or the wherever they came out of the budget was a reaction to that court order.
Ms. Timmons. Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, that would be correct.
Before I go to you, Senator Osmond, I think the difference, how I interpret it, is that those were individual cases that came up. This is a process that the legislature debated, passed, and so there's a process for this type of activity, just as there are processes for the other claims. And is it a perfect fit? Well, we did have to modify our rules, but it does seem to follow the precedence that if there's a set process that, you know, we can go through the claims. Will that be changed, maybe interpreted differently in the future? Possibly, but I see a slight difference from, you know, an individual disaster with the bridge or individual, you know, judgment from the courts. But I think I'll go to Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, another question. You know, in these three awards, do we know, were these awards put in place by the judicial branch because they felt if there was an award, the word if is important in this, if there was responsibility as deemed by the legislature that this would be appropriate, or was this they have determined that the state is responsible, therefore this is the award? I'm still trying to sort through this on where this where this is falling, because I really do have an issue with two of these cases.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Osmak. My answer, as the author of the bill, and Senator Lass was the author in the Senate, but my understanding is that it is the latter, is that the legislative language, the bill that we passed, provided a rubric for them to follow, and they made the determinations that these cases met the criteria under that rubric, and therefore assigned the award based upon how we directed it. Now, there are representatives of MMB here, so if they wanted to answer differently, they could, but that is my answer.
I'm getting indication that there is no need for MMB to interject, so Senator Osmak.
So, in the converse, so they could actually, we could, as we continue down the path of these cases, which certainly we're probably going to see more of them, it's entirely possible that the judicial branch could give us a award of zero in some cases? Is that a probability? Even though they were exonerated, it was found that the state is not liable?
But before Representative Lesh responds, if there was time served in incarceration or time under observation, there are minimums set in the statute, so it'd be difficult to have a zero, but I'll yield to the author of the bill, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Osmak. My understanding and recollection of the language is that exoneration in and of itself does not mandate an award. Okay, so the answer to your question for me is yes, a zero is conceivable. However, if the criteria are met, including exoneration, and there is in fact time spent in prison, then the award would not be zero.
Senator Osmak. Any other questions? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it seems like before we vote, we do need to just get confirmation, unless I miss this, from the Department of Corrections, that yes, in fact, the statutory process was used in all three cases. And so if we can just get that confirmation, then it seems like we'll have satisfied what Ms. Timmons has set out.
Representative Pinto, I believe MMB testified.
Oh, it was MMB. My apologies. Wrong department.
Well, that's okay. Oftentimes it's confusing for people, and I see the Deputy Commissioner approaching to give clarification. Deputy Commissioner Hillstrom.
So just on that point,
yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, the statutory process was followed, we believe, to the letter, starting with the order for eligibility from the district court through the Supreme Court and then through the panel appointed by the Supreme Court.
And
thank you, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's true for all three of the claims under consideration here?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, thank you.
I think we're probably at the point where we can accept a motion for each individually or all three. Representative Fenton, sorry.
Mr. Chair, I would make a motion that we accept all three together, make a motion to approve all three together.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. It passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. And now I assume there's going to be a few people leaving as we shift into the normal claims. I do have something for the committee council to. I need some advice on whether something's divisible. And I believe it's here. It'll be right here soon.
Oh, okay. Oh.
And to those that haven't been involved in claims, our resident counsel on the committee is retiring and has been enjoying this activity for several years. And just a little bit of appreciation, thanking her for over 1,000 claims. And it's not cut, so she can determine divisibility of that article. And now on to item 6 of the agenda, claims against the Department of Natural Resources. And if anyone that is interested in testimony, if you could move towards the front, and I'll have Ms. Timmons maybe give some background for the members.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, I'll give a little background before trying to divide the big cookie, I guess it is. Thank you so much. We have two claims against the Department of Natural Resources tonight. The first claim is the claim of Mark Ryak. And Mr. Ryak was charged with a misdemeanor charge of failing to check his traps on a daily basis. And he was acquitted after a jury trial. So he now brings a claim for $19,317.72. And I will make a couple of observations. One is that there is a potential remedy available in tort, that of a malicious prosecution claim. And I will also make the point that an acquittal is not the same thing as an exoneration. As we just heard from the three previous cases, there was quite a lengthy process to determine that the individuals were exonerated and innocent of the charge. And so with that background, perhaps the other testifiers could proceed.
Okay, and members, we've got a multi-page staple that sort of covers the claims and the department recommendations and recommended amounts for reference. And if the testifier could mention her name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sherry Ensler, and I am General Counsel for the Department of Natural Resources.
Mr. Chair, I'm Mark Ruyak.
Thank you. And why don't we start out with, actually, why don't we start out with the claimant? If you would again state your name and then give your statement.
Yes, sir. I'm Mark Ruyak, and I was the one who was falsely accused by the DNR. I grew up in northern Minnesota. I'm a West Point graduate, Gulf War vet. I've worked 14 different places around the U.S. and Canada for Michelin Tire and moved back to our great state of Minnesota in 2007. And it's an honor to sit in front of you today. I've never been at the Capitol building, and I've never sat in front of a group of our representatives and senators. So I just want to say it's an honor to be here. This is what I went overseas to protect, and it's neat to see this process and see what's already gone on tonight here. That being said, in the first wolf season, I am a trapper up north. I did snare a wolf. It had a collar on it, and I actually initiated the contact with the DNR because I went to see the game biologist up in Grand Rapids and attempt to sit down and talk with him and just learn more about the wolf I had caught. And it ended up not being a very friendly or cordial meeting, and I left there wondering why I went in to talk to him. Several weeks later, I received a knock from a conservation officer on my door. Was questioned repeatedly for a long time and eventually given a citation. My wolf was taken away. I guess to my benefit, I had already gotten it to a taxidermist, so the pelt had been tanned, but they did take the wolf, the pelt, the snare, everything. I spent just over a year and a half in court trying to proclaim my innocence or prove my innocence, I should say. Did that in a jury trial, and during that process was not only told I'd never get my wolf back by the DNR, but I was also treated pretty harshly by the prosecuting attorney, to the point where the judge had to ask him to stop talking so that I could finish on the stand. We proved in court that the game biologist really didn't know a whole lot about GPS data or about collaring or anything else, and neither did the DNR official, and that really they were out to strip me of my wolf and try to prove that I was guilty of an infraction when I wasn't. And I was found innocent, and all charges were dismissed. I should say I was found not guilty. All charges were dismissed. And that was in late September, September 25th. And as they had said, the DNR said, well, we'll give you your snare and your tag back, but you're not getting your wolf back. So I worked with Senator Tom Anzells and contacted the late Dave Dill at the time, Representative Dill, and they worked their channels up through the state government. At the same time, one of the people that testified on my behalf was a retired game warden who had grown up with me and knew me as a trapper. He testified on my behalf, and when they said they weren't going to give my wolf back, he started talking to the head of the DNR down here in St. Paul. Finally, after about 2 weeks, they contacted the lieutenant who was pushing this whole thing. The lieutenant and the biologists were pretty much the pushers of the whole thing, and they told them that he had to give me my wolf back, and I got it back. At that point, I contacted Representative Anzells and was thanking him. And he suggested that I come through this process because I was wrongfully accused, and try to get my some of the money back that I had spent defending myself.
Well, thank you, Mr. Ryak. I would like for clarification, so you do have possession of the wolf.
Yes, sir.
And I'd like to understand, what are the out-of-pocket expenses that you incurred as part of this? Not anything outside of what you spent for legal expenses, Mr. Ryak?
I pretty much, other than legal fees, was just lost wages and travel were the only expenses I asked to be reimbursed for.
And Mr. Ryak, the total?
Mr. Chairman, lost wages was $4,320, and travel was $700.
Thank you. And legal fees?
Legal fees were $14,297.72 for a total sum of $19,317.72.
And General Counsel Ensler, if you would wish to again state your name, affiliation, and give your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sherry Ensler. I'm General Counsel at the Department of Natural Resources. So in this case, Mr. Ryak was charged with failing to check his traps on a regular basis, as required by Minnesota Statute 97A.301, Subdivision 1, which requires that if you have a permit to trap, that you must check your traps on a daily basis. Mr. Ryak did trap a wolf. Mr. Ryak had a valid permit to trap. The wolf was a collared wolf. Mr. Ryak brought the collar into the DNR to the DNR's research biologist, Mr. Sampson. Mr. Sampson has been studying wolves using collared data for over 20 years and is very familiar not only with GPS systems, but is also very familiar with the behavior of wolves. He has published in this arena, in this area, and published with some of the world experts on wolves. Mr. Sampson reviewed the data on the GPS collar. That data indicated that the wolf from December 18th through December 20th stayed within a 25-foot radius of where the trap was located. Mr. Sampson, based on his extensive history as a wolf biologist and his extensive knowledge, said that this was, and testified at trial, that this was highly unusual. He contacted a conservation officer. The conservation officer met with Mr. Sampson, and then he went out and interviewed Mr. Ryak. In reviewing the transcript of the discussion between Mr. Ryak and the officer, there was some testimony that suggested that Mr. Ryak did not check his traps on it, in which Mr. Ryak admitted he did not check his traps on a daily basis, but rather looked for whether a stick or a marker had tipped on the side of the road. Based on the experience of Mr. Sampson as a biologist on the interview at question, on the GPS map, which is attached in your packet to the affidavit of Officer Wickman, who was the conservation officer involved in this matter, Conservation Officer Wickman issued a citation to Mr. Ryak. He then proceeded to take his file to the county attorney's office. And I want to emphasize that it is not the conservation officer who makes a determination about whether to prosecute in any given case. It is the county attorney. The officer will make a decision to forward the matter to the county attorney if he believes that there is probable cause that a crime has been committed. The county attorney then evaluates the file and makes a determination not only whether there was probable cause, but whether there is sufficient evidence in the record to indicate that a crime has been committed. In this case, the county attorney made an independent assessment and decided to proceed with the charge, and a jury trial was held. At the jury trial, Mr. Ryak is correct. He was acquitted. After the trial, Mr. Wickman's supervisor polled the jury. And the reason he decided to poll the jury was he was concerned or wanted to make sure that the DNR in the future learn from this experience. When the jury was polled, and all of the jury members were there, they indicated to Officer Wickman's supervisor that, in fact, they thought Mr. Ryak had probably violated the statute, but in their view, the map, which is in your packet, was not clearly labeled, and so the state had not met its burden, which in a criminal case is beyond a reasonable doubt, the burden of showing that Mr. Ryak had committed the crime. So Mr. Ryak was acquitted. He was not found innocent. He was found not guilty. Now, in this case, Mr. Ryak is requesting that you reimburse him for the cost of his attorney's fees and lost wages. The guidance for this committee is, and this committee is established, to provide an opportunity for reimbursement to private parties in matters involving the state where there is no other alternative or no other method to provide reimbursement for an aggrieved party. In this case, there is an alternative mechanism for Mr. Ryak to be compensated. Minnesota Tort Claims Act, Minnesota Statute 3.736, Subdivision 3, provides for a cause of action against the state and says the state will pay compensation for injury or loss of property caused by the act or omission of a peace officer who is not acting on behalf of a private employer, and here Officer Wickman was not acting on behalf of a private employer, who is acting in good faith. And I think that we can all admit that this officer was acting in good faith. He had probable cause to believe that a crime was committed. He forwarded the charging material and the evidence to the county attorney. He was acting in good faith. And under circumstances where the state, if a private person, would be liable to the claimant, whether arising out of government or proprietary function. So here we have a situation where Mr. Ryak could file a claim under the Tort Claims Act either in a regular court or conciliation court. Secondly, there's a compelling public policy reason for this court to deny this claim. The Minnesota Supreme Court and Congress.
Let me interject.
Okay.
This is a committee on claims, a joint committee on claims. We do not adjudicate.
Right.
We are not that part of the, not that branch. And if you could maybe sum up and close.
Sure. Well, I would suggest to this court that, or to this, excuse me, to this committee, that in this case, Mr. Ryak was charged with probable cause, and he went to trial. If this court, or if this committee, were to go down the path of awarding compensation for every person that was charged with a crime for which probable cause existed, the claims before this committee would be innumerable, and it would have a chilling effect on enforcement of our laws in this case. So the DNR would respectfully request that this committee deny this claim in this situation. Thank you.
And thank you. And I'd like to move to members' questions. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've read this claim very thoroughly, and I understand that we know that between 10 a.m. on 12/18 of 12 and 10 a.m. on 12/20 of 12, the wolf was in this same area. The map may not have been labeled. I do not know why the state would be culpable in this. Mr. Ryak has stated that he may have missed a day on 12/19. So we're looking at a period of time that does not fit with the law, and I just don't see that the state has been wrong. I don't think the state has been a wrong party. That you are a wrong party. The state has not done wrongdoing.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Ryak.
Mr. Chair, it was brought out in court, and also the members of the DNR that I talked to at all, above and below the level of the officers that came out, and it was brought out in court that just because a wolf is in a certain area, those of us that live up there and are around them all the time know that just because they're in an area doesn't mean they're in a snare and that they're in a trap. And in fact, the snare was only 6 feet long, so if the wolf was in a snare, it would not have been able to travel in a 25-foot radius, and that the wolf had a deer leg bone in its mouth, so it had been feeding before it had gotten caught. So it was very definitely in the area before it got caught, and it was proven that probably, more than likely, it was not in the snare for that period of time. It was the biologist who pushed it, and I don't even fault Officer Wickman because he was being directed, and he was not acting on his own because in the interrogation of me, He left, went out to his truck, made a phone call, came back in with a very, very different mood and tone of voice, and gave me the citation and didn't want to talk anymore. So he was being directed by the biologist and by the lieutenant over him to make this happen.
Mr. Ryak, for clarification, within the close proximity, was there a source of water? And also, since you stated that there was part of a deer, was there within that proximity the carcass of the deer?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there is a pile of deer bones and carcass. And in your packet, you also have a picture of the wolf, and it's very obvious that there's snow that's hanging on the branches in very close proximity to where the wolf was, so there's no way he could have traveled 25 feet without knocking that snow off the branches. So it was very obvious and very clear that he was not in the snare.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Members, any other? Senator Scalzi.
A lot of you may not know this about me, but I trapped when I was a kid. My brother and I trapped. I grew up in Barrette, and that's what we did. We were very poor. We trapped to make money. But I will tell you that there never was a day that went by that we did not check our traps. And we checked them every day at 6 a.m. before we went to school. To me, that's something inviolate in Minnesota law, that we do not make our wildlife, when we kill them for whatever purposes the law allows, that we do not allow them to suffer. And I checked my traps every day at 6 a.m., and I would never let a day go by. So that's why I would move that we deny this claim, because I do not believe that the state did anything wrong.
We do have a motion.
And, Mr. Chair, can I say
One moment, Mr. Ryak. We do have a motion before the committee. Is there discussion on that motion? I would mention that the chair has trapped, but they were all gopher traps.
Can I make one statement, Mr. Chair?
And Mr. Ryak, since a motion is before the committee, we would complete that and Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just want to note that that our first rule of procedure is that if there's a claim which may be made in another tribunal or court, that we don't have jurisdiction anyway. So any discussion about whether or not the claim was valid or the details of trapping or really anything about the DNR's conduct or any of that, that all would be the second step. The first step is we don't have jurisdiction over this because a claim may be made in another place anyway. So that would be yet another reason to deny the claim beyond any of the substance that we could possibly talk about, because the claim could be made elsewhere.
Further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, same sign. Motion passes.
Mr. Chair, can I make one statement?
A very brief one, Mr. Ryak.
Extremely brief. I just think that to ask people to go through another round of court cases to address this is not the way it should be done, in my opinion. Well, because I can tell you, after going through a year and a half of court, the last thing I want to do is go back to court. And that's why Representative Anzell's asked me to come here.
Thank you, Mr. Reck.
Yes.
I understand, and the process as it is, and we have acted.
Yes.
But thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. And the next item, do we have the claimant, Savitsky? Hey, Mr. Savitsky. And then if Fiona Ruthven could also approach. And then when I have you mention your name, and affiliation, if you can, tell me how I mispronounced. And we'll start out with Ms. Ruthven.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Fiona Riven,
Riven,
the staff attorney here on behalf of the DNR. Mr. Savitsky has submitted a claim. I don't know if the committee would like to hear from him first since he is the claimant.
Well, by all means, ladies first.
The claim before you involves a timber permit that was purchased by Mr. Savitsky in 2014. Like many state timber permits, the land at issue does not come with access. Mr. Savitsky's claim seeks reimbursement. Effectively, he seeks to refund the timber permit and claims damages for lack of access to his equipment and certain timber that was felled. The permit at issue had a timber appraisal report that specifically and repeatedly identified to the buyer that the access to the sale site, the timber, was across private land, that permission to cross the private land would be required to access this permit, and is the responsibility of the permittee to obtain. Access is across private land. Permittee should ensure access agreement before purchasing the sale. These disclaimers were also made by DNR staff orally to Mr. Savitsky prior to purchasing the timber permit. The timber permit itself included a provision at the end that said, I read and understood the conditions of the permit along and included the timber appraisal report. Mr. Savitsky apparently managed to gain the private access to the land and began timber harvesting. Under the timber statute, before harvesting under a state timber permit, the permittee is to contact the DNR and to have what's called a pre-meet conference in which they can discuss the harvesting activities and the like. This site, the permit also noted that the harvesting activities should happen under dry ground and on dry/frozen soil conditions. That is a common condition on timber permits to avoid damage, not only to the state land, but to any access. And that's another reason why the DNR, the statute, and its procedures have these pre-sale conferences. It's in order to ensure that the DNR knows harvesting is going on. And one of the reasons to do that is once the harvesting is going on in the frozen time, when it starts to get to spring, around kind of a little bit before now, you know, the spring breakup, DNR goes around and says, you know, spring breakup's coming up, you're going to want to finish your harvesting in order to avoid damaging the land and move your equipment. Because Mr. Savitsky didn't inform the DNR before he started his harvesting activities, the DNR didn't know that they had started, and so they first learned about the equipment being on this site without access in May when Mr. Savitsky came to the DNR to complain about his inability to retrieve the equipment. Although Mr. Savitsky had access to the site originally through a private agreement with a neighboring landowner, that landowner revoked the access due to concerns to damage to his private property in the access and the moving of the equipment across the site and did not want the equipment moved during the summer. This is agricultural land, didn't want it damaged. Over the course of the summer of 2015, the DNR went to the site, saw that harvesting activities had actually been conducted. There are pictures in the DNR submission that show that timber was felled at the site. At the end of September, determined that the land conditions had gotten to the point that the equipment could potentially be removed if access could be addressed through the private landowner. These are the Hulzings. The Hulzings ultimately granted Mr. Savitsky access to the site again in order to remove the equipment on condition that the DNR was there to supervise it to avoid any further damage to the site. After the removal of the equipment, Mr. Savitsky's asked multiple times that the DNR refund the full amount of the timber permit. Minnesota state law specifically provides that once a permit becomes effective and cutting commences, the permit holder is liable to the state for the permit price for all timber required to be cut. That is in statute, is a long-standing statutory requirement. It's in Minnesota statute 90.151, subdivision 4. Accordingly, DNR informed Mr. Savitsky that the permit could not be refunded under state law. DNR does not believe it committed any wrongful conduct in this case. The lack of access to the equipment was to do with a private access dispute over which the DNR had no control or authority. From the outset, they informed Mr. Savitsky of the need to ensure the private access, and he failed to abide by the statutory procedures that could have prevented this issue, because, as I said, if the DNR had known about the harvest operations, they could have advised him earlier of the need to remove his equipment, and potentially this landowner dispute wouldn't be a problem. The permit expires in May 2017. There's other potential access points to this area. Another possibility would be an assignment of the permit to a responsible bidder or to somebody who's a qualified logger who could access the site. But the DNR respectfully requests that this committee deny the claim. Does not believe that the law as written supports granting the relief that's being sought or the equities or that there was any wrongful conduct on behalf of the state in this matter.
Thank you. Before we move to Mr. Savitsky, a couple queries. One, is there ever, because of extenuating circumstances, an extension given to a permit? And two, is this the first case where something similar has happened with access being granted and then withdrawn?
Mr. Chair, members, I have somebody here who's from the Timber Permit Program who can maybe answer those questions. If I may bring Doug Tilma up to address those issues.
If he's right there.
Yeah.
Because members, my thought being a little bit of background, whether there could be an amended agreement between the parties, and the other, if this is not the first time, that might be part of the reason why the language of meeting with the DNR, et cetera. So if you could state your name and affiliation.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Doug Tilma. I'm the Timber Sales Program Supervisor for the Minnesota DNR. And to answer your question, this is not the first time that a permit holder has maybe had some issues trying to gain access across private lands into a timber permit. Our timber permits are 3 years in length, and they do provide in state statute a one-year extension. If there's issues like this or weather or any other extenuating circumstances for completing the permit, this permit has not been extended and so would be eligible for a one-year extension.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Savitsky, if you could, in your testimony, give us an idea, since harvesting did commence, if there were any proceeds from that, and then go with, and if you'll state your name for the record and begin.
My name is Richard testimony. Harlan Savitsky. I live in Mille Lacs County. And she's right, I'm not a professional logger. I'm just some okey pinokey that burns wood in his wood boiler. And I basically was tired of doing the firewood cuts up there because he could never get enough wood to burn, to heat. So basically I had to go to school, to logger school, to learn how to cut trees and whatever to get this permit and license to buy and go to the auctions. Every September they hold an auction up at the office in Onemia. And they auction off tracts of land. And this one was perfect for us. We don't, like I said, we just have a tractor and a skid loader. I got permission from the Halsings. Mr. Halsing and Mrs. Halsing both gave me permission to go in there. We explained what was going to happen. The reason why I never got the permit is the day I paid for the sale, Pete up at the station had me sign it, and he said, I'll fill it out, and we'll give it to you later. Okay, the understanding I had is that when I left there that day, they said, give us a call, let us know when you're going to start, and we'll be there. So it was 2 weeks. I called them. I said, I don't know, it was during the week. All the calls get routed to Little Falls. And I left a message that we're going to be down there Monday getting ready to start cutting. Well, you know, I signed the permit. And what's amazing about this permit is everything that they're talking about that I didn't do is on a stupid thing they never gave me. It says everything about the meeting and about having a ceremony to put this permit on a tree or whatever. I'm not a logger. I'm just some guy that wants to get some wood to burn. So it came down to the point where Mr. Halsing, basically, after finding out what kind of a man he is and the area that it is, basically, to sum it up, he's nuts. He came down there, and we were actually removing our equipment at the time we were supposed to, okay? Before frost went out and everything, he came down there at, I think it was 6 in the afternoon, whatever it was, with his dog and his gun and the whole nine yards, and me and my son were out there getting our equipment out. He said, you ain't going anywhere. And he basically, this land is landlocked. Are any of you familiar what landlocked is?
Yes.
Okay. You cannot landlock a piece of property anymore in this country. And I went over this with this gentleman over here quite a few times. I said, in the state statutes, it states, they have the right to cut an access into that property. And it's 6 pieces of paper that you can download off the internet and take it to the Mille Lacs County judge.
Mr. Savinsky, part of what we're looking at, you know, if there's legal recourse against the people pulling out the access, that would be another.
Really easy, sir.
Okay,
really easy. Two things can happen here. One, I can get my money back because they falsified this sale to me. Okay, and I can prove it. They couldn't get rid of this sale because of Mr. Halsing. I've already took the Halsings to court 3 times in Mille Lacs County, small claims court, civil court, the whole nine yards. The judges up there just throw it out and dismiss it. They don't have a clue of what landlocked is. I forget what the statute is. Do you remember?
I don't.
But the Minnesota state statute and the federal government has one, too, that says you can't. So I asked this gentleman here on the phone, well, what do we need to do to get a road in there? He said, well, if you find another logger, like she said, and I did. I got a friend up in Treagle that owns a sawmill, and they were cutting down there now. So I approached him and asked him. Well, he went over to Halsing, and Halsing chased him off his property with a gun. He said, nobody's cutting this wood. And that's the end of it. So I went, you know, and I told Pete that up at the office, what you told me. He said, if you find someone else, Rick, to buy this sale, and he was going to buy this sale for me, would have been done. All they had to do was put the road in. And they can do it. Takes 2 weeks, and they could have put the road in. Problem is Halsing doesn't want it. But now, what was it? I was up there 2 weeks ago getting a burning permit from Pete. And it's amazing. Pete kind of told me that Halsing owns a chunk of property that the state forest would like versus, you know, the one that sits that I was logging. So I'm going, well, what does this mean now? You know, that we're swapping land or something? The whole thing is put the road in or give me my money back. I gained the assets, went through the court systems, the whole nine yards. I'm out a ton of money. I collect disability. I was trying to teach my boys how to, you know, cut wood.
On the merits of this discussion, I think we have a good idea of where you're coming from. It would be nice to get clarification from the DNR whether there was a recording of the phone call.
There was no recording of the phone call, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Members, are there any questions? Discussion? Any motions?
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Osmak.
Feel free.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, could Ms. Riven talk about that landlocked part?
Ms. Riven.
Mr. Chair, members, that there are numerous my understanding there are numerous tracts of state land that are landlocked. A lot of the concern about the landlocked land and access has to do with, you know, residences and the like, and there are numerous areas of landlocked state land. The way that's we have a lot of state land, a lot of state timberlands that are landlocked, and they have these, and they are put out for timber permit, but it is a condition of the permit that you get private access. And I would note that the permit itself, because of that, is that it's sold at a discounted rate because of the access. And the timber appraisal report indicates that there's a discount for that. I mean, could the state use eminent domain to get a access? It could, but there would be a significant cost.
$35 filing fee at the county courthouse.
Pardon me, we're trying to maintain.
If you've dealt with this for as long as I have.
I understand things get very frustrating. We're trying to stay organized. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Riven, could you tell us, you told us that the expiration date isn't until May 31st, 2017, but with the history that you have about this particular parcels, where Mr. Savitsky could clear, how would you think he's going to find a way to do that between now and 2017?
Ms. Riven.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, as I indicated before, there are other access points. Mr. Halsing, I would note, had revoked the access but ultimately did allow the equipment to be removed. There are ways for the for a private access agreement through other other landowners could be negotiated. As indicated, the permit could be assigned to somebody else who perhaps has less of a contentious relationship with the private landowner. I mean, this is a private, I think it should be apparent that there's a private dispute here that the state is not necessarily involved in, and was throughout the process, the DNR was upfront about the need to generate the access.
Representative Murphy.
If I may, I believe.
I don't have any more.
Okay. Briefly?
Briefly. If I remember, you told me no matter what happens, you got to get that track cut. That's what you told me on the phone. I wish we had a recording, but I'm just saying you told me that no matter what we do, Rick, we got to get that track cut. So if you can find another logger, which I did, and he went over there and tried to access the land to see the to see what he was getting into, and Mr. Halsing chased him off the property.
Mr. Civet.
That's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
You guys want to go up there and talk to Mr. Halsing?
I would like someone from the DNR to give us an idea. You're landlocked. There's other tracks. How accessible are the routes to the other tracks? Because I can understand if there's bluffs, streams, etc., you might have other parcels around, but they might not be accessible, so to speak.
Mr. Chair, there's many, many interspersed state-administered 40s, 80s across northern Minnesota that are landlocked by other ownerships, county, federal.
Yeah, let's cut to the quick.
Sure.
That specific one we're actually discussing, and this claimant,
right.
Are those other avenues reasonably accessible or not? That's more of a yes or no.
That's correct. There's a private landowner, Mr. Halsing. There's another private landowner as well. I believe these are ag lands that are surrounding at least two sides of this 40. The fact was that Mr. Savitsky did obtain private land access across this 40 and
That's already been ascertained, and the query was just to see get an idea for the other accessibility. My understanding is that Very quickly, Mr. Savitsky.
The other gentleman that they're talking about is Gary. He owns the other acreage next to it. It's been family-owned for like 80 years, and he doesn't want anybody touching his land. It, you know, it's a private, it's their family thing. I talked to him very
nice. It's understandable. It's up to the individual.
And he said that if you have no way of getting your equipment out, he says, in the middle of winter, I will, you know, that be the only thing, which he was nice enough to offer, to get my stuff out.
Oh, okay. I think, members, we probably have, unless you've got any other questions, we probably have a good feeling for, you know, the dispute. I'm looking to see if someone wishes to make a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
I have one more question.
Certainly.
When someone is in this situation, do you pick the area that they're going to go and log, or does the person pick the area from a map or something? Do they know ahead of time that this is not a very good promise for them?
A very brief description of the process which the people select.
Mr. Chair, the process is we have a stand exam list. Our foresters know the particular stand. They visit that parcel of land and do an assessment in order to sell it. There's a map and an appraisal that goes along with it. So we're very familiar with the land that's being the timber harvest is being sold from.
Representative Murphy.
But Mr. Chair, when you're very familiar with the land, and but you're probably not as familiar with the person that's asking to buy the permit. And so how do you match the right person to the right spot?
If I may rephrase that, this is just, you know, the parameters, do you limit or is it a straight auction, so you really don't have, other than there's certain criteria that they must meet in order to bid?
Mr. Chair, members, I think there may be, this is not a case of the DNRs matching it to somebody. There are these various permits that identify the area and have the little map, and the loggers choose to bid on specific permits. This permit went out for bid at an auction. There were roughly 20 or 30 permits that went out for bid, and people could look at the specs and determine if they wanted to bid on them. No one bid on that permit at the time at that auction. After, I think it's 30 days, after a certain amount of time, those are then available for over-the-counter sale. So the unpurchased permits, individuals can come into a DNR office, look at the specs, and determine if they want to purchase that for the price as opposed to going through the auction process. So it's not a question of the DNR matching a site to a logger. It's a question of the logger saying, I want to buy this permit for this site.
Representative Murphy, and I think what's included there is, as the claimant even said, he had to go through a training to be qualified to bid on that. Representative Murphy. Okay. Senator Osmick.
Mr. Chair, because the permit is still live, if I'm reading this right, the permit is still live until May 31st of next year, I don't necessarily see a damage at this point. I move to deny the claim.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. And motion passes. Thank you. And that looks as if we have completed item 6, and we're now on to item 7. I'm not sure if any, you know, there are some people. If you're in the MSOP section of the agenda, if you want to approach, and I'll have Ms. Timmons give some background to the committee.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, we're now into two property claims against the Department of Human Services. The first one I thought was a relatively straightforward loss claim. You certainly can hear it if you wish. I recommend a denial on that one. The second one, the Christopher Critch claim, I thought you might want to discuss because I don't believe we've discussed the concept of scrip before in the subcommittee. It is sort of like money that is used in the sex offender program. And so one of the concerns I had is, was this really money that originally came from Mr. Critch's account, or it sounds like there wasn't really clear evidence that the money did come from his account, and in any event, he had more scrip than he was supposed to have. But I thought, so it may be one for denial ultimately, but I thought the subcommittee might want to hear about scrip.
And it looks as if both Ms. Rosen is going to testify on both. And if you could start out with the first one, name and affiliation for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jensina Rosen, and I'm the due process and compliance specialist at the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And did you want to start with Mr. Bantu's?
Yes.
Okay. So Mr. Bantu's claim was he alleged that MSOP property staff damaged his headphones when he sent them to be restickered. They need to have, because they're a durable item, a tamper sticker next to it just so we can track those durable items within the facility. He alleges that they were damaged during that process and requested $31.49 reimbursement. After talking with the property staff who were responsible for handling the headphones, it was determined that there was no mishandling or damage done to those headphones while they were restickering the headphones. So the tort claim was denied, and Mr. Bantu appealed to the subcommittee.
Okay. And ma'am, name and affiliation?
I'm Jessica Guile. I'm the Legal and Records Director for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. I'm here for any other additional background information.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Motion to deny the claim.
Any discussion? All in favor? Signify aye. By saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Thank you. If there could be some background on scrip. Ms. Rosen.
Mr. Chair, scrip is it's non-cash currency that's used in the facility. It's akin to property. So clients can spend $40, which is at the time for Mr. Critch's claim, up to $40 to buy scrip in the facility, which is like property, which can be used for different transactions within the facility. They can only have, at that time, up to $40. It has no cash value outside of the facility. And so if a client is moved into a specific unit that doesn't allow scrip, they can redeposit that back into their account, which is the case for Mr. Critch. However, at the time he was moved into a higher behavioral needs unit, he had $130 of scrip on his person, which the $90 that was different was taken as contraband. At the time, the $40 of scrip that was separate from the $130 was redeposited back into his account. But as Ms. Tibbins indicated, there's no evidence that he ever purchased scrip. So at that time when we had the policy, if he had the $40 of scrip, it could be redeposited. In this case, he had the $40, it was redeposited, and the other $90 where we had no evidence where it originated from was secured as contraband.
Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the inmate was aware that any more than $40 worth of scrip on him is in violation of the rules of the facility. Is that correct?
Correct.
Mr. Chair, motion to deny the claim.
Any further questions on the motion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion passes.
Thank you.
And thank you. And we are now on Agenda item 8. And Ms. Timmons.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. Item 8 are the claims. It will be under 7,000, perhaps, assuming that passes the legislature. But right now it's claims under $500 that the department paid during the past year, and they've provided documentation that they paid a total of $608.79 worth of small claims.
Do you need a motion?
We need a motion. Typically, we would have that as reimbursement or payment to the DOC in the claims bill.
Mr. Chair, motion to approve the payment per staff recommendation.
Senator Osmek has made the motion. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion passes. We're on to the item 9, the injuries. And Ms. Timmons.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, the first injury claim is Robert Bolden. This is a claim for $6,999. The date of injury was August 19th of 2015. And while at work, Mr. Bolden claims that a fluorescent light bulb fell from the ceiling and injured his left small finger. He was treated. Ultimately, there was no evidence of a permanent injury. The department recommends denial, and I am in agreement with that.
Any questions from the committee?
Gotta go one more page.
And since no questions, any motions?
Mr. Chair, motion to deny the claim.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion passes.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Osmek.
I would make a suggestion that rather than go through every single individual one of these 70, well, I'm sorry, there's 10 of them, that if anybody wants to talk about one specifically, that we do so and then wipe them out with one motion.
Thank you, Senator Osmek. The chair did send out a memo or some correspondence saying that on the property claims that if anyone wanted to pull one out for individual discussion, we would. I think, though, from last year we did request additional information on number 3, item 9A3, Mr. Burton, because there was additional information. You should have that additional information. The recommendation was to hear, discuss, and the recommendation was to deny. So maybe if we could do that one separately, and then we could maybe entertain a motion to accept the recommendations on the remainder in this section.
Sounds good to me.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Oh.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think a number of these, maybe not all, but a number of these involve the remaining claims for injury involve some recommendations for payment. Mm-hmm. There's only 9 of them total, including the couple you identified. Mm-hmm. So I guess I might suggest it might be worthwhile, since there's only 9 and several involve payment or things to assess, maybe if we address these 9 and then the property claims are sort of a separate thing. That'd be just a suggestion.
I would bow to the committee. Senator Osmek seems to agree. How about if we have Ms. Timmons step through them, and if there are any questions, we can address them. If not, someone could maybe make a motion on that individual one, and we can cover them. Ms. Timmons.
Yes, Mr.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, before we start, could we have on our little chart, we have a claim amount, and then that might not be the cost of the injury.
Correct.
What?
how do we get to the claim amount?
Ms. Timmons.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I'll walk through each of the injury claims, and I'll spend a little more time on the ones that where a payment is recommended and state the payment amount. But I will try to be very brief on the ones where I'm recommending denial so we can move through quickly.
Okay.
So the next one is Lerone Brown. That is one where a payment is recommended. It was an injury at Faribault where Mr. Brown cut the left middle finger on a fan blade and cut the tip from the first knuckle onward. So two ratings here, 2.5% for the partial amputation and 0.5% for a mallet deformity of that finger, for a total rating of 3%. And the amount recommended for payment by the department is $2,250. I am in agreement with that recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt that.
Representative Murphy. Okay. Discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion passes. Next, Ms. Timmons.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, the next claim is the Antonio Burton claim that you had before you last year. And so you may recall this was the inmate who was hit on the nose with a steel pipe. And fortunately, the nose healed properly. It functions fine. But there were a couple of medical notations that he did have a slight deformity of the nose. And so there is a potential to rate this under the schedule. And if the committee determined to pay for the cosmetic impairment to his nose, the workers' compensation schedule would indicate a $3,000 amount. Now, you may recall that this was laid over last year because the department had recommended denying the claim and had recommended denying based on before and after pictures of Mr. Burton's face. And the subcommittee members asked for larger pictures. And so there are larger and even color pictures in your packet that show the before and after. So the options here, and I believe the department, maybe Ms. Netzer can make sure of this, but I believe the department is still recommending a denial on this one.
Chair, Ms. Netzer.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. Yes, the Department of Corrections wanted to remind the committee that the cosmetic payment for a cosmetic injury while someone is in prison, this might be one of those times that the workers' comp ratings and schedules might not conform completely with the, you know, with what happens in prisons. You know, taxpayer money going to a cosmetic deformity when it does appear to be rather minor, at least in our estimation. Again, we recommend a zero rating in this case. There is no breathing problems in this case, and so we do make a recommendation of zero. Also, last year we had pointed out to the committee that we are required for cosmetic deformity to wait 24 months, which makes the most recent photographs the most important ones to consider.
And Ms. Netzer, if you could give your name and affiliation now to cover for the record.
Of course, Chair. Lisa Netzer, I'm Associate General Counsel for the Minnesota Department of Corrections.
Okay, members, Representative Fenton.
I would make a motion that we deny the claim because it sounds that medically everything is working properly. So.
Okay, so a motion has been made. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion passes. Ms. Timmons.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. The next claim is for Alexander Cedarblade. This is one for medical expenses only. Mr. Cedarblade, I think, was actually a minor when he was doing STS work in Isanti County. He had a slip and fall. There was no permanent injury, but medical providers in the area who treated him have claims that total $2,398.28. The department recommends payment of those, and I'm in agreement.
Members? Senator Scalzi.
I would move payment of the claim for $2,398.28.
Thank you. Discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion passes. Ms. Timms.
Yes. Mr. Chairman and members, the next claim is Nathan Eckstein. This is another sentence to service case, this time from Brown County. It involved a left ring finger being caught in a wood splitter. So Mr. Eckstein was definitely treated for this injury. The medical provider claims are $1,083.58, and the department recommends payment of those. I am definitely in agreement with that. The claimant also originally requested wage loss, but ultimately did not submit documentation, so the department recommends no payment for wage loss. I am definitely in agreement with that. The only thing that is an issue, so I understand that Ms. Nicole Lind, an associate of Ms. Netzer's, had called Mr. Eckstein. He stated that he had no permanent partial disability. However, when I look at the medical records, the medical records do talk about an amputation of the end of that finger. And so if the members did want to pay for that, that would be a 2.5% rating or $1,875. And perhaps Ms. Netzer would want to add something.
Ms. Nesker?
Chairman, members, we haven't received a claim for a rating from Mr. Eckstein. He simply wanted the medical providers paid, so that's why we have not requested a payment to be made to Mr. Eckstein. He was not interested in it when he discussed it with Ms. Lind.
Senator Osmek.
Mr. Chair, a motion to pay the medical providers to the sum of $1,083.58.
Any discussion?
Just briefly.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm trying to understand. Let me think. So there was a portion of the claim, I guess, for lost wages that he sort of disclaimed. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if the portion, if the additional funds that Ms. Timmons is referring to, you know, it just wouldn't have even occurred to him that he could make a claim for. Because if he, you know, suffered an amputation of part of his finger, I'm just, you know, that's a hesitation that I have about restricting it to the medical bills. If he would, I mean, did he actually, was he aware that he could have made that claim and specifically chose not to make it?
Ms. Timmons, if you had info.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Pinto, that is why I provided the information that I did to the subcommittee members, simply because I think sometimes when people are asked if they have a permanent disability, they're thinking about, do I have, you know, a permanent disability so severe that I can't work, something that would be qualify me for Social Security disability or something of that nature. And, you know, I wasn't sure that this person did know that there might be a claim of permanent partial disability for the loss of the fingertip. So I thought it was worth considering. Now, I mean, of course, if claims can always be reopened, I mean, if he were to submit additional medical documentation, the subcommittee could hear that claim again at a later time.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm wondering, is there some way of having him be able to make that claim? I guess the concern I have is just we've got his fingers amputated. He's made a claim for the treatment of that, but he is would be entitled something which we certainly would consider. I think, in fact, mm-hmm. just in the past few minutes, we've made we awarded a claim based on somebody's fingertip being amputated. Mm-hmm. So it feels a little strange to me to simply be restricting to the medical bills in that case. I'm wondering if it's something where he could be made aware this is a claim he could make, and if he could choose to make it at another time. I'm
well,
not sure.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Pinto, I would caution the precedent set without the proper paperwork of a claim. And so I would recommend, as Senator Osmick did at this point, simply what was requested and that we do have paperwork for, and that of the $1,083.58.
And I do believe that if this bill goes through, it'll cost $8 to submit a new claim for that additional. Representative Pinto, you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I want to confirm. So he could, in fact, make a claim for the amputation next year then, I guess. Is that right?
Representative Pinto, based on the nods I'm seeing, yes.
Okay. Just got to know, there is the paperwork in the sense of it's got a medical provider who said amputation of fingertip, but I do understand that if he hasn't made that claim, so I guess perhaps he could be made aware that is something which he could at least make the claim for. Obviously, we would then review the paperwork, as Representative Fenton said, in a future year.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Timmons, could he make the claim for the fingertip and his lost wages?
Ms. Timmons.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, he could. If he provided evidence of wage loss, he could.
Mm-hmm. It'd be cheaper if we did the 1875.
We do have the motion before us. Seeing no further discussion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion passes. And it appears as if there's just one recommendation to pay remaining for Mr. Merrill. Ms. Timmons?
Yes. Michael Merrill is an individual who I think this happened at Stillwater rather than Faribault. I think he's at Faribault now, but it happened at Stillwater, right?
Correct.
Okay. Anyway, he picked up a piece of steel and said he fell to his knees with major neck and back spasms. And this was one where I asked Ms. Netzer to get additional medical testimony, which is in the extra packet that Casey provided to all the subcommittee members. Because this individual has a very complicated medical history, many falls, he had a prior fusion surgery. But then, after this work-related accident, he did need a second fusion surgery. And Ms. Netzer was able to get a very good medical evaluation, and the doctor really parsed out what was due to underlying conditions or prior injuries, what was due to the work injury. And the upshot of it was that there's a 3.5% rating for the diminution in the neck range of motion, 2.5% for the fusion, which is a total of a 6% rating, which equates to a $4,800 payment to Mr. Merrill for his permanent injuries.
Senator Osmick.
Motion to pay the requested amount of $4,800 on this claim.
Discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion passes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Osmick.
Motion to deny all remaining injury claims in Section 9.
Discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion passes. And on to the property claims. And as was stated in the correspondence, We requested if anyone felt there needed to be something pulled out and discussed. Otherwise, we were looking at having a motion to go with the recommendations on the remaining property claims. Discussion, Representative Fenton.
Mr. Chair, I would make a motion to go with the recommendations on property claims.
Discussion? Seeing none, all in...
Mr. Chair,
Representative Pinto.
I think our counsel has identified a couple of these claims that she thinks may be worthy of discussion, and I wonder if it would make sense. I've identified three, it looks like.
Right.
Perhaps I could get that confirmed with Ms. Timmons.
Ms. Timmons, if you can denote the number on the agenda of those three.
And I the number. Let's see. I know that Casey marked them with a red flag. One is Joe Brown. That one is number 19. The second one is Raphael Bryson. That's number 21. And the third one is Christopher Foy. That is 29.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you. Those were ones that I had looked at because I noticed that there was hear or deny. But in the instance of Joe Brown, that was the one where his shoes were found in a different cell.
Mm-hmm.
The owner there said that he had bought them from someone else. And so I just don't know why we would pay that.
Representative Scalzi, I understand that. There is a motion by Representative Fenton, and maybe Representative Fenton would amend the motion to remove these three so we could continue the motion on the rest. Representative Fenton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will amend the motion to remove the three and then accept recommendation on all the rest.
Thank you. Discussion? Seeing none? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion passes. Okay, if we can start with...
I wonder if it maybe is important to note...
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It may be important to note for the record that the recommendation of council was denial. I just wonder if we should have that as part of the record.
I think Representative Pinto, that. Since you stated it, it is now on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Timmons, if you can go to 19, 21, and 29.
Yes. Joe Brown, I pulled out. I think it probably is ultimately a denial, but it struck me that when in the normal course of the world, if somebody steals your property and then the police are able to recover that, it might be confiscated initially as evidence, but you would typically get it back. In this case, it wasn't quite that clear. Joe Brown said this other guy stole my Nike shoes, and then indeed Nike shoes were found in the other offender's cell. And the other offender at the disciplinary hearing said, well, you know, I bought them from somebody, but I'm not going to tell you who. And the policy of the Department of Corrections was that even though, you know, maybe these were, in fact, Mr. Brown's shoes, that they were to be confiscated. And so it seemed to me that the subcommittee might want to hear some of the policy reasons behind that. Then there was another thing in there, Ms. Nicole Lind, who has a new job at the Department of Human Services, and that's why she isn't here tonight. But she wrote in her letter about how, you know, we don't have any way to identify all these personal shoes. Well, and I'm sorry, it's been a long time since I had a kindergartner, but I had this immediate flashback to buying this indelible pencil and marking my kindergartner's stuff with, you know, on the inside of their shoes and the tags on the clothes and the coats and everything. And I thought, well, gee, that's an idea I never thought of. And then I actually talked to Ms. Lind before she moved to her new job, and
I understand the department has a committee that's looking at things like that, but hasn't found a solution. So I thought we might have some testimony from Ms. Netzer.
Ms. Netzer.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. This is an important claim for us because it actually touches on a number of security issues. I wouldn't actually call it a policy issue. This does set up, though, a number of security issues within the facility that don't reflect everyday life out on the street. In a facility like ours, when staff do not observe what happens between offenders and simply have one offender saying, hey, those are my shoes, he must have taken them, and another offender saying, hey, I got them from someone else, but I can't tell you who, we have no evidence, no circumstantial evidence to help support one or the other. We cannot take one offender's word over the other, or we set up a power situation where security becomes an issue. Offenders who are believed over another offender have more power. And we do not want to feed into power struggles between offenders. So in order to remove the power, we remove the shoes. That's as simple as it gets, and is not really a policy issue. It's a security issue to help avoid those sorts of power struggles. We don't know if those shoes were bought and sold five times before we got there. We don't know if that person stole those shoes. We don't know if they were given away. We don't know if there was a debt paid. We don't know, and that's part of the problem. The other thing is that there the question about why don't we simply pay a claim like this? We only pay claims where there is evidence of a negligence on the part of staff members. And so in this type of case where an offender's shoes go missing and there isn't any allegation that a staff member had anything to do with it, we don't pay on those. Unfortunately, offender on offender property exchanges or forcible changes, this is prison. We do pay when there is staff misconduct involved, and staff do work with offenders. If there is a claim that someone has stolen something, we review videotape. Those cameras are not hidden. The offenders know those cameras are pointing into cells 24/7. We do try to review tape and help offenders out as best we can when there are complaints. And we do what we can, but we can't solve every missing piece of property in a facility like this. Finally, IDing shoes. The big problem with IDing personal shoes is, number one, marking up someone's personal shoes on the outside, and then marking them on the inside and coming away with big, stinky adult feet as opposed to cute little children's feet that don't sweat as much. I wish that there was an easy way to do this, but we simply haven't come up with a great way to identify or get an OID number to stick on the inside of a shoe. They seem to disappear. And offenders are great at making things disappear. We do actually identify, and we do put OID numbers on televisions. We put them on hot pots. We actually scratch them into the casings on those. At a number of facilities, we're using Sharpies to mark state-issued clothing and other things. So we are doing it where it's possible, and we're getting better at it, but we're not 100%. And as soon as we figure out the shoe issue, I will let you know, because I will be very happy if we ever come up with a way of marking shoes that works.
Well, the chair is very surprised that we haven't reached perfection, and there are still issues, but apparently life is life. Representative Fenton had a question.
Well, I would just say, in hearing that we should deny this claim, I make a motion that we deny.
Discussion? Seeing none. Oh, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This one I did start to ask some questions about, too. You know, looking at a lot of these, mm-hmm. I do wonder, a lot of them are missing property from the cells. And it seems like, you know, you mentioned that there's video on 24/7. Is there insufficient video? Or is there something else that can be done? Because, you know, it's just on and on and on here with stolen property. Now, I think there's been TV sets missing. You know, I don't know if the video shows them leaving the back door, leaving somewhere, it seems like there's a lot of things that just go into the air. Now, last year we had a question about a ring, a gold ring, which, you know, that one really troubled me that we did not do any reimbursement for that ring. And it probably was not correct to reimburse because you're not supposed to have a ring. But nonetheless, the ring was, in the words in the claim, was disposed. And we're seeing the same thing with the tennis shoes here, that they were disposed. Now, you know, I guess I'd like to see something different happen. And I don't know if you have Sharpies that the inmate might be able to use if they so choose to mark, because if they don't mark them, okay, then, you know, you don't get them back when they're mm-hmm. stolen. But if you do mark them, it seems to me that it would resolve some of these things. For a lot of this property, if you're able to mark it, if you're able to photograph it, if you're able to do something, and just about everybody now has a phone that they can photograph at the same time they do the inventory so that they can be identified later on. So I guess I'm imploring that more be done to identify this stuff, because, boy, this has got to be expensive to write up all of these complaints like this, and especially if we're only asking for $75. Mm-hmm. That you know, make us all, we can all be more efficient if there's something else done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may change that question slightly to, if there is evidence outside of testimony from inmates, offenders, is the item returned to the person? So that if you had video evidence that was taken, is it returned to as opposed to confiscated? Ms. Metzger?
Chairman Quam and Senator Carlson, we do, if we can find video evidence to help support information that we get, then we do go ahead and to the best that we can, return property where we can. For instance, there are times when we observe people around a cell, but maybe we can't see what's going on or what might be being passed hand to hand. That doesn't mean we don't check out those cells where those offenders are from to see if, oh, look, there's a new pair of earbuds in here suddenly, or, oh, there's a new something. You know, it helps us narrow our searching, but we can't search all, you know, 200 cells on one side of a cell block in Stillwater when that happens. I wish we could, but we can't do that many shakedowns in one day. So we do try to, if we can find more circumstantial evidence, we do. I did want to let you know that we did look into that ring issue last year after we had this committee meeting. And what we found out, and you did make one payment. We had a minimum payment for a ring, and so we did pay back the $100 that we had for limits for rings. But we found out that not only, yes, things are truly disposed of, and this is a very important area of the prison where things are disposed of quite literally, but that the DOC has had to fire a CO who was found to have been violating the policy of how to dispose things. We take disposal of offender property. When we say we're disposing it, that means it's not up for grabs. It is disposed of, and there are no exceptions. So I know there was some question about that, whether we would really throw away a ring. The answer is yes.
Senator Carlson, follow up? Or?
No, thank you. Thank you for that advice on the ring also.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, very briefly, just the letter that was sent out in response to this claim for DOC kind of emphasized the fact that there's no way to determine if the shoes belong to you. That's how we got into the permanent marker of the shoes and all. As I understand your testimony, though, even if you knew for sure that these were this offender's shoes, the claimant's shoes, it wouldn't matter, because if you didn't know whether it was stolen or sold or whatever it was, then per security reasons. So I guess I just want to make sure that we're clear on that, and perhaps you're clear in future claims about exactly sort of what we're dealing with. Because, in mm-hmm. fact, it sounds like in this case, once there's a transfer of property, if you don't know how the property was transferred, it doesn't matter if you know whose property is or not. Am I understanding that right?
That's correct. I mean, really identifying these shoes wouldn't have helped very much because once they're out in the out of the offender's custody when they were his and they were marked on his inventory. Once they're out floating through the system, they're we don't know how they got there or under what circumstances.
Thank you.
Okay. Further discussion questions? Representative Murphy.
Just one question for curiosity. So somebody's wearing new shoes or different shoes than they usually wear. Mm-hmm. If nobody's saying, he's got my shoes, does that person get to keep wearing those new shoes?
Ms. Nestor.
Well, you're counting on officers going through 200 pairs of shoes and noticing who's wearing which ones. And unfortunately, unless they're LeBron James style, crazy expensive ones or not, I highly doubt those. The officers are keeping track of which shoes are on which feet. Unfortunately,
So in most,
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, in most cases, then it's finders keepers.
Ms. Netzinger.
Chairman Quam and Representative Murphy, I think, unfortunately, that we can't fix everything in prison, and we do our best, but there are going to be things that get through and get happen under our radar. We try to fix it when we find it.
We got a motion.
Yes. Further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion passes. Ms. Timmons.
Yes, Raphael Bryson is one where the staff did offer to replace his beard trimmer attachment, but the claimant refused because he also wanted some clothing that was uninventoried, so he wouldn't be able to prove that he had it in the first place. So the only question here is, does the committee wish to pass a motion to direct the Department of Corrections to reoffer the beard trimmer attachment, or would the subcommittee prefer to simply deny the claim?
Senator Osmick.
Mr. Chair, I make a motion to direct the DOC to reoffer to replace the beard trimmer attachment and deny the claim.
Discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion passes. And Ms. Timmons on our final claim.
The final claim is Christopher Foy, and this is one where quite a bit of property went missing, including a TV and a remote, earbuds, tablet charger, and then some other smaller things. And the claimant alleges that his cellmate was getting out of prison that day, and that he believes his cellmate gave the items to other offenders. The DOC says they looked at videotapes and just couldn't see anything, that the cellmate took things. But I just had some questions because there was a lot of property here, including a TV, which is a large item that is kind of difficult to go missing, I would think. And those are tracked with serial numbers. I also thought the fact the documentation showed that the DOC did move claimant to a different cell block after this loss of property incident. There seemed to be some knowledge of some problems, and so maybe Ms. Netzer can shed more light on this claim.
Ms. Netzer, I thought that you could not transfer, buy and sell a TV except through the official process, and that that's why I'm somewhat curious about. If you could enlighten us on this.
Sure. That is absolutely correct, Chairman Quam, and members, that you cannot buy and sell a TV except through the canteen process. However, we do commonly come across in when we do a cell shakedown or when we're packing a property, a TV that has a improper OID on the back or a scratched off OID on the back. It's not unheard of when someone has a TV that's broken, suddenly they have a TV that works, that, you know, things get moved around or switched around. In this particular case, something that we don't try to document in public records, I can say that this particular offender was facing a safety issue involving gangs within the prison, and that is why he was removed from the living unit where he was. Due to that, I can say that the officers on this case did, in fact, both review the video and also did some cell searches of known gang members. However, by the time they got there, obviously the property had been passed along further than those that were in the immediate vicinity, and they could not locate the property. They did try to assist this offender. His roommate who was released, there didn't appear to be any actions on his part that were improper. He didn't leave the facility with any untoward property. He only left with the property that was his. There might have been a question of access, but you know, there was some gang involvement in this particular case. They tried to help him out, but more importantly, they got him to a safer place, and he decided to reside in a different living unit at that time.
Ms. Netzer, one clarification: if an inmate is leaving, are they free to gift their internal possessions, or is there a restriction on that?
There are restrictions on that, but they can give some property away, such as books, pictures, things of that nature, hobby craft items, and things like that. But an offender receiving it has to still comply with the correct amount of property. And again, a TV is not an item that you can give to another offender. It has to be shipped out. Okay. The rules are very clear about that.
Well, thank you for the clarification. Senator Osmick?
Mr. Chair, motion to deny the claim.
Further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion passes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Osmick.
Is there honorable ways and means chairman wish to make a claim tonight? We are in a mood to claim off money for you.
Just waiting to get the final total, Senator.
Motion to adjourn, Mr. Chair.
The chair is reviewing and confirming that there is no additional.
Mr. Chairman and members, there is no additional business to come before the subcommittee tonight.
Well, thank you. And before we adjourn, I do want to say that even though she's still to determine if this is divisible, there are four dozen already separate cookies available to celebrate wonderful service from the counselor. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
They're right behind you.
Yes, I'm done the ball program first.